From London today comes one reason for Britain's recognizing the communist government of China.
Recognizing a government doesn't in any way imply approval of its character. Come to think of it, if it did, there'd be very few governments that would recognize each other.
The National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you Voices and Events, the living record of history this week. You'll hear President Truman, Senator Taft, House Speaker Rayburn, China's ambassador to London, the voice of President Roosevelt, these and many others, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
As the week and the new year began, everyone knew what was coming. History will note that the news was given the world on the morning of Friday, January 6th, 1950.
This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Yesterday's statement by President Truman, in which he declared that the United States would pursue a hands-off policy in Formosa, was followed today by the recognition by the British government of Mao Tse-tung's communist administration as the new government of China. Accordingly, Britain no longer recognizes the Chinese nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek.
Thus came the news from Britain, confirmation of the news actually. Earlier reports had left little doubt that here was to be the first major difference in the post-war world of the great powers in the West. When the announcement was made, newsmen hurried to the embassy of Nationalist China in London and listened to the words of Cheng Xianxi. There was great sorrow in his voice as the emissary of Chiang Kai-shek spoke to British reporters.
I naturally deplore the decision of your government, not only as ambassador of my country, but also as a true friend of this country. It has been the repeatedly declared policy of the British government not to intervene in the war in China. But what greater intervention could there be than giving recognition to the communist regime at this moment? It is equivalent to burying us whilst we are still very much alive.
Even though the British decision was known in advance, the American State Department intimated that U.S. recognition of China's communists was not likely in the immediate future. Still, the administration's ideas provoked violent words from those who insisted on a far stronger policy on the part of the USA. Foremost among those critical of our present efforts is Senator William Noland.
The policy of the state that the State Department has been following in China has given aid and comfort to communism and has been detrimental to the peace of the world and the security of the United States. In Japan, General MacArthur's administration stands out like a beacon light in the dark and stormy Far East.
And what of the dark and stormy Far East and the reaction in American headquarters there in Tokyo? This week, an account of intrigue as a supposedly secret State Department memo became public knowledge. A memo that wrote off Chiang Kai-shek's last stronghold, Formosa, as a hopeless cause. We heard that story from NBC Tokyo and George Thomas Folster.
A confidential State Department memorandum has been distributed to all information officers out here in the Far East for their guidance. This secret bulletin says that it should be stressed that Formosa is the exclusive responsibility of the Chinese government. So there you have it, what seems to be the State Department's policy on Formosa. Not strategically important, keep out. Most military leaders in the Far East do not agree with the State Department. Most military leaders in the Far East believe that Formosa is important.
Such was the view of General Douglas MacArthur and others of the high military command. And it was shared by ranking Republicans, among them Ohio Senator Robert A. Taft. In Washington this week, they asked the question bluntly. Did Senator Taft think the American Navy should be sent to the troubled waters off Formosa?
Yes, I think that the way to prevent the communists from crossing into Formosa is to have the Navy see that they do not do so.
There then, a situation that severely split London and Washington, a situation that finds many of influence in our own nation denouncing the policies of the government, even more outraged at the action of Great Britain. We ask, why did Britain give recognition to Mao Tse-tung? And to get an answer, Voices and Events switches to London for the full story from a leading editor, a famed MP, and the man on the street. First, NBC correspondent Merrill Muller.
Confused and embittered by American attacks against their intentions, the British government hoped for an early Far Eastern conference of democratic powers to reaffirm a common policy with the United States toward Asian communism. In this attitude of writing off all anti-communist Chinese, The Foreign Office is echoing the almost righteous sentiments of the British public at large. The government's own political voice is Labour's Daily Herald. And to get their viewpoint, we asked its diplomatic editor, W.N. Ewer, to report direct.
This business of British recognition of the new communist regime in China seems to have caused a lot of rather stormy criticism in the United States. But frankly, we don't quite see why. It just seems to us something that all countries will have to do sooner or later, and we can see no particular point in waiting. You see, recognizing a government doesn't in any way imply approval of its character. Come to think of it, if it did, there'd be very few governments that would recognize each other.
To check these opinions, we took our microphones to the House of Commons and called on famous author Vernon Bartlett, independent member of Parliament from Bridgewater. Mr. Bartlett.
One thing in this mess and muddle is clear. If the Americans recognize one Chinese administration and we, the British, recognize another, there may be the gravest consequences both at Lake Success and along the China coast. And yet we both want to do the same thing, to check the spread of communism into Southeast Asia. The trouble between us surely is that we haven't yet agreed whether this is a military or psychological problem. Personally, I'm convinced that military measures create far more communists than they destroy, and that the only effective defense against communism is the removal of the ignorance and misery in which it can thrive. If we had faced up to facts and had recognized the Chinese communist government months ago, that government might not now be so closely allied to the Russians. However, better late than never, and that is one of the reasons why we are recognizing the government now.
For a final test, we took our microphone to Piccadilly and interviewed a number of men in the street.
Could you give us your idea about this situation as it's developing in the Far East?
Well, of course, it's awkward for me, really, but I must say that on reading what I have read, that the British political view on this, I do agree with. And as far as the Anglo-American relationship is concerned, well, I do think that, like everything else in the past, we have come to some agreement that has proved successful on both sides.
My name is Frank Dunyer. I live a little bit outside London, at Beckenham, which is in Kent. My feeling about it is this, that I think the communists have already overrun China. There's nothing we can do about it there. We've just got to accept the position, and in that respect, I rather agree with what the British government is doing in recognizing the communist government in China. But I do think we ought to go all out as far as we can to stop the threat from extending to other countries.
From the Foreign Office to the man on the street, the British feel the way to combat the communist menace in Asia is not in military planning, not in diplomatic indecision, but in an economic program to lift the living standards of the Asian masses so that Asian democracies themselves can prevent the chaos on which communism breeds. This is Merrill Muller in London.
The story from London would seem, for now, finished. But that's far from the case in our own capital, where at week's end, the Republican minority is still indignant at Britain's action and the State Department's refusal to defend Chiang Kai-shek. Senator Kenneth Wherry speaks.
This action, crime actions, a long series of blunders in which the Moscow-directed communists have been coddled and appeased by the Truman administration.
Does all this mean an end to our bipartisan foreign policy? Some correspondents think so.
This is Cliff Stratton, correspondent for the Topeka Daily Capital. First, when I first came here to report for the Capital 23 years ago, we didn't have any bipartisan foreign policy. Yesterday afternoon, I discovered again we haven't got a bipartisan foreign policy, and I think it's a good thing.
Foreign policy, a top problem for both Republicans and Democrats in the Congress just begun.
Time out from the worries of the world for a Chicago man who can't quite figure out how to bring on the dancing girls.
You may remember Christopher Janis as the fellow who made headlines when he bought Adolf Hitler's car, there being no further use for it in Germany. Well, comes now Christopher Janis, the lucky heir to an uncle who died in Egypt and left him a plantation, lock, stock, and dancing girls. And as he told reporter Len O'Connor, every bit of it a fabulous place.
So when my uncle left me this property, I came into possession of camels and donkeys and the people and the dancing girls. Actually, there are 12. There were about 12 in this community, and I'm entitled, according to the will, to 4 of them.
Do you get your selection, or how is that decided?
Well, no, I think the lawyers over there are more or less dividing the girls up. But it seems all 12 want to come over. But I have to make up my mind, first of all, whether or not we're going to bring them over, because it's a bit of a problem. They don't speak English, and their food habits are quite different from our own, and their other habits are quite different, too. So I can imagine it'd be rather complicated when I get them over here.
Does Mrs. Janice approve?
No, I don't think my wife likes the idea too much, and I don't blame her. But several movie people have urged me to bring them over to show them around. But I'm not sure that's going to work out. I always feel if it doesn't work out, I always could use them perhaps as babysitters or something of that sort.
In view of immigration laws, language difficulties, and other problems, will Mr. Janice actually bring these dancing girls to America? Latest word is that he probably will not. But a man can dream, can't he?
For the people of Water Short, New York, the big drought was still serious this week, but not without humor.
Just to rub it in, some enterprising Texans sent a tank truck to our town loaded with the best water in Texas. They made a ceremony of it and invited New York's Water Commissioner Carney.
Commissioner Carney, it gives me great pleasure to present this truckload of water to you folks.
Thank you very kindly. I accept it on behalf of the city of New York and express to you and the people of Texas our sincere thanks for their kindness and thoughtfulness.
Taste that good Texas water.
Thanks very much. First today.
I'm from the Bronx. This Texas water tastes pretty good, but I'll still stick to the Bronx champagne, seltzer.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
Like many a town, Washington began the new year with a hangover, a headache left over from that business about the five percenters. The weeks-long probe of Washington's influence peddlers finally brought some results this week. Indicted by a federal grand jury was that somewhat mysterious man about the Capitol, John Marigon. The trial, of course, is still to come, but with the news of Marigon's indictment for perjury before Congress, it seemed fitting to call on the man who asked most of the questions. His name, Senator Joseph McCarthy.
What do you think about this Marigon thing?
Well, I think the grand jury did Truman a great favor by getting Johnny Marigon off his doorstep, at least temporarily. Seriously, as you know, Marigon is merely one of these small fish in this vast net of government corruption and fixing. We sincerely hope that the Justice Department takes advantage of all of the information we gave them and finishes the job cleaning out.
The Capitol may have its Marigons, but oh, to be in Washington now that Congress is there again. Yes, the lawmakers returned after Christmas merrymaking and fence mending, and besides the legislating that lies ahead, let's not forget the social season. Bit of a problem there this time, says reporter Nancy Osgood.
Washington society is all aflutter this week, for the return of the congressman to Capitol Hill means a shot in the arm for the social season. The dowagers who dominate society here are asking lots of questions. For instance, who'll take over as the leading hostess now that Pearl Mester, the administration's unofficial but very busy hostess, is way off in Luxembourg? There's talk that the president and first lady will do the best they can. Several dinners in honor of the newlyweds. These at Blair House, which seats only 16 around the dinner table, and perhaps using Lee House next door. 18 at a time can dine there. But 16, 18, or what have you, no one doubts that Mrs. Barclay will be the belle of the evening. Other than that, the basic old rules for the social merry-go-round here still apply. You invite at least one senator, an important ambassador, a lesser important but charming ambassador, maybe a visiting celebrity, as many pretty women as you can find, and, of course, extra men, the same graying bachelors who turn up everywhere. This is Nancy Osgood in Washington.
The White House is still in a sad state of disrepair, with carpenters rather than socialites tramping the corridors, but the workmen managed to get the houses of Congress done over in time for the new session. How do they look? Well, perhaps the answer should come from one of the guides who show the tourists about.
I'm Ralph Cady. I'm fortunate in having been here 20 years, and I take great delight in showing people through the building, as well as other guides do feel the same way, of course. Now, the new roof that just recently been completed is a thing of beauty, and people have made many very complimentary remarks in regard to it. And the lighting facility is so much better. And people will look at that, and then they'll glance down and see the congressman, and they have a great deal to see here while on their visit to Washington.
There was scarcely room for tourists when the big moment came, the convening of the second session of the 81st Congress. NBC's veteran Washington reporter, Earl Godwin, was there.
The president, addressing a joint session of the Congress, creates the most exclusive gathering in America because outside the folks who are in the House and Senate on duty, and one guest each for the 531 senators and representatives, plus a few Democrats and the White House people, there were today exactly 40 extra seats to be divided among 40,000, so it seemed, enthusiasts who wanted in. The doorkeeper in charge of these sessions is Fishbait Miller of Mississippi. You can spot him on the front cover of the Saturday Evening Post this week. He told me the pressure on him for tickets to see the show today was worse than the mob scenes and demand for tickets at any one of the last three Democratic national conventions where they nominate a presidential candidate, and you know what those shows are. And that's all from Godwin at this time.
You know, the opening of Congress, coupled with the new year, is a great time for reflection and taking stock. It's not alone for the president to report on the State of the Union. How about hearing it from an old-time lawmaker, a man like House Speaker Sam Rayburn?
Did I think the country is in as good or better shape than I've ever seen it? Our national income is high. The farmers of the country have made a good crop and sold it for a high price. It gave them a buying power and some net income. Nearly 60 million people are employed at good wages and good hours and in decent working conditions. And I think corporations and business generally in the country have made a splendid profit.
Then that dramatic moment when Congress convenes. Little business the first day, the roll calls, swearing in new members, and always after the first of the year, this resolution.
Resolved that the two houses of Congress assemble in the hall of the House of Representatives on Wednesday, January 4, 1950, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, for the purpose of receiving such communications as the President of the United States shall be pleased to make to them.
Next day, President Truman drove along Pennsylvania Avenue to the high-domed Capitol, and to the Congress and the nation delivered his State of the Union message. In his address this year, there was something more than the words of a president of the United States. There was the measure of a man. NBC's Morgan Beatty saw it and heard it.
In today's message, there is contrast between the Truman of 1945 and the Truman of 1950. The man carries the same humility for his maker, but none of the deference he showed the Congress 5 years ago. Today, his voice is sure. Even when he flubs his words, his convictions, his objectives are clear. In 1945, his voice carried an uncertainty. He was awkward 5 years ago in the shoes of leadership. Note in this first passage how he almost jumped the gun before he was properly introduced by Speaker Sam Rayburn.
Mr. Speaker.
Just a moment. Let me present you, will you, Harry?
Sure.
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure and the high privilege of presenting to you the President of the United States.
And then President Truman carried on. His voice was hoarse. He read his words in a spirit of shocked uncertainty. He said,
"Tragic fate has thrust upon us grave responsibilities. We must carry on."
And now, 5 years later, almost, note the difference in the tone and the feeling in his voice. It's a sign of the evolution of the man, President Harry Truman. Here's his opening passage to Congress today, January 4th, 1950.
A year ago, I reported to this Congress that the State of the Union was good. I am happy to be able to report to you today that the State of the Union continues to be good.
And here's a highlight that illustrates the quick-thinking master of politics before Congress. This next passage has its roots deep in immediate political strategy. The Democrats will go before the electorate this fall and blame spending on the Republicans of the old 80th Congress. On this point today, Democrats, some of them cheered the president, applauded. Republicans jeered. You could hardly tell the difference in the sound, but jeers and cheers there were. And note how the president insists on making his point above the roar of the lawmakers. Here's the passage today on taxes.
At present, largely because of the ill-considered tax reduction of the 80th Congress, the government is not receiving enough revenue to meet its necessary expenditures. To meet this situation, I am proposing that federal expenditures be held to the lowest levels consistent with our international requirements and the essential needs of our economic growth. I think I'd better read that over. You interrupted me in a minute. To meet this situation, I am proposing that federal expenditures be held to the lowest levels consistent with our international requirements and the essential needs of economic growth and the well-being of our people. Don't forget that last phrase.
And now, finally, the brief theme, the text of today's Truman Report on the State of the Nation.
Today, by the grace of God, we stand a free and prosperous nation with greater possibilities for the future than any people ever had before in the history of the world.
Indeed, here was a changed man. Political victory after victory had brought confidence, mellowness to Mr. Truman. As columnist Walter Lippmann phrased it, here was a man sitting on top of the world, finding it comfortable and pleasant up there above the turmoil and the hullabaloo, displaying a technique of never dealing with problems, but only with the excellent results that would be achieved if the problems had been solved. The day after his appearance before Congress, with more messages still to be prepared and delivered, Mr. Truman turned up at a dinner of the American Federation of Labor, and in high good humor, too.
I've been over at the House all evening, working on two more messages on the State of the Union. One of them's ready. It's going down tomorrow. It's the economic message. And then I have one that's creating a great deal of conversation, known as the budget message. Everybody seems to know all about it but me, and I'm the only one that knows all the figures in it.
The occasion for this dinner was the anniversary of the death of labor's great statesman, Samuel Gompers, to whom the president paid tribute. Labor has come a long way since that time, he said. And then Mr. Truman observed,
I remember when he passed away. He passed away in 1924, in the year in which I was defeated for re-election. They never succeeded in doing that to me since.
This, then, the story of a Congress convening in the first days of what promises to be a critical year. Plenty of predictions, a host of trouble signs as the lawmakers begin their meeting. No one to say for sure just what lies ahead, but we can go back on the record of history to an earlier uneasy day. Knowing what was to come, we can listen with wry interest to these words from 10 years ago. This is the actual moment as it happened the week of January 1st, 1940.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carlton Smith of the National Broadcasting Company speaking to you from the United States Capitol Building in Washington, D.C. We are to bring you at this time the opening of the third session of the 76th Congress, and to do this, we have set up our NBC microphones on the floor of the House of Representatives. The Congress begins.
House, please be in order. Members kindly refrain from conversation during the roll call.
Europe was at war. The Pacific was at peace. In the House, Representative Joe Martin was minority leader, as now. The Speaker, William Bankhead.
Fellow citizens, I guess you recognize that as a term of greeting of an old-time politician. My dear friend, Joe Martin, the leader of the minority in the House of Representatives, happened to come into the booth in which we're speaking, and I could just call his attention to the fact that we might have some politics in this session of Congress, and Joe said he hoped that we would, and I join in that wish myself, because without some politics here in the House of Representatives and in the country, particularly in a presidential election year, it'd be a rather dull and stupid affair. I'm happy to be here with my good friend Speaker Bankhead. While we may differ on policies occasionally, we all know that he's one of the ablest speakers and the fairest speakers that ever sat on the chair. Patriotism above partisanship. The national welfare above the national election. Americanism above every imported ism of hatred and despair. Such are the pledges and promises which marked 1940 as a year of brighter vision, new hope, and new achievements for all our people.
Before another January, the USA would be at war. Even now, the clouds over Europe cast a shadow. Here's NBC's Earl Godwin, 10 years ago.
The effect of Europe's wars on American welfare. That subject seems to be uppermost in the mass congressional mind as these lawmakers gather here today. Leaders who have seen the president's message, which will be read to the world at 2 o'clock, admit that this foreign equation bulks large in the forthcoming address, which the president will make on the rostrum of this House to a joint session of the Senate and the House. The president's philosophy on foreign affairs can be gauged by his previous remarks, I think. He hates war, and he has accented that hatred. He envisions peace someday. I think he has said that he sees no United States Army abroad at any time, but already national policies have been put in motion showing that this Congress will be asked freely to give in the causes of national defense.
2 o'clock, January 3rd, 1940, Speaker Bankhead.
Members of the Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, I wish to each and every one of you a very happy new year. As the Congress reassembles, the impact of wars abroad makes it natural, I think, to approach the State of the Union through a discussion of foreign affairs. May the year 1940 be pointed to by our children as another period when democracy justified its existence as the best instrument of government yet devised by mankind.
That's how it was 10 years ago this week. The signs of what lay ahead were there for all who could read them. Then, as now, newsmen reflected on developments at the turn of the year, attempted to judge their importance. From that same week in January 1940, this moment from a news broadcast by John Gunther.
On one page of my newspaper today, I saw a chronology of political happenings, like the resignation of Litvinov as Russian foreign minister, like the lifting of our arms embargo and the new Neutrality Act, like the capture of Nanning by the Japanese. On another page was an inconspicuous story of, quote, "There's no doubt in the minds of those who follow the work of the laboratories that the outstanding discovery of 1939 was the splitting of uranium with the release of such enormous amounts of energy that even the physicists are willing to concede the distant possibility of doing away with ordinary fuel to light cities and drive factory wheels," unquote. Now, this is, of course, of the utmost potential importance. Scientists are cautious people. But if anyone ever succeeds in harnessing atomic energy, the whole basis of life on this planet may change.
That's how it was as we watched and listened 10 years ago.
This has been Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Today you heard the voices of President Truman, Senator Taft, Vernon Bartlett, and China's ambassador to Britain. From the past, the voices of President Roosevelt and Speaker Bankhead. Portions of this program are broadcast around the world through the facilities of the State Department's Voice of America. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
What's on NBC today? You'll hear some of the most important news in years. Today on Confidential Close-Ups, Bob Hope reveals his plans for Bing Crosby and gives his opinion of Charles Boyer and Errol Flynn as lovers. And that's not all. Rita Hayworth's father, Edward Cansino, will talk about his famous daughter. Hear Bob Hope and all the Hollywood celebrities on Confidential Close-Ups today over most of these NBC stations. Remember, hear Bob Hope and Rita Hayworth's father on Confidential Close-Ups today on NBC.